I know one advertising director who is quite comfortable using her power upward, but not downward. She consistently makes the most of her access to upper management, getting involved in high-level projects and developing a valuable network of executive allies. But because she is reluctant to address performance issues with her staff, people sometimes question her management ability. Whenever you fail to capitalize on your position power, you automatically reduce your leverage. Personal power derives not from your position, but from your own special characteristics and abilities. We all have innate strengths that can increase our personal power. Jessica, a secretary in an office that I visit regularly, is a cheerful, outgoing person who always remembers my name and the fact that I drink tea. Her friendliness is completely genuine. It's just part of being Jessica. Because she is a natural people magnet, Jessica has a lot more personal power than those secretaries who barely look up when someone walks in. Her warm and friendly nature automatically creates allies and will serve her well in any job she ever holds. Andrew, a director of marketing, has a different gift. Much of his personal power comes from his obvious intelligence. A graduate of both West Point and the Harvard Business School, Andrew was an electrical engineer before embarking on a career in marketing. Among his colleagues, he is known as the person to seek out when you are trying to think strategically about a problem. However, any strength carried too far becomes a weakness. Andrew is so bright and so serious that he can sometimes make people uncomfortable. As he described it, I really don't like nonsensical banter that is not edifying, which clearly illustrates that Andrew could benefit from learning to lighten up a bit. Increasing your personal power means not only using your strengths, but also reducing your weakness. As we saw with Steve and Rose, evaluating someone's political power is not always simple. Even in the Army, where everyone is labeled, one three-star general is not necessarily the political equal of another. Here are some questions to consider in determining a person's power level. Do top managers know who they are? Could the CEO find their office without a map? Do they talk more about the past or the future? Is their body language confident or submissive? Do people listen when they speak? Do people trust them with information? What meetings do they attend? How many people know who they are? With whom do they have lunch? What email distribution lists are they on? Who can they go to see without an appointment? When they want something, do they get it? Being able to accurately assess the distribution of power is a fundamental aspect of political intelligence, one which can help you safely navigate political minefields and avoid political pitfalls. These power clues may be helpful. People with high power are included in important decisions, are well regarded by people at all levels, communicate with people in high-level positions, have information or skills that are valued by others, are trusted with confidential information, are involved in important projects, have expertise that is hard to replace. People with low power may not be doing important work, may talk a lot about the past, may try to sound more important than they are, may drop names of important people, may like to spend most of their time alone, may have little interest in their work, may avoid conflict or handle it poorly. Avoiding foolish power mistakes. When it comes to using power, people make a lot of mistakes. Some timid souls, fearing that they will be perceived as pushy, overbearing, or insensitive, simply give their power away, often empowering obnoxious colleagues who actually are pushy, overbearing, and insensitive. At the other extreme are the egomaniacs, who try to look as if they have more power than they really do. They seldom fool anyone for long. And then there are the aggressive types, who fight for dominance, getting into blatant public power struggles that only make them appear silly and immature. One common mistake is to give domineering people more power than they should have, simply because they wear you down. Several years ago, I was helping some young managers in a nonprofit organization to plan their annual staff retreat. Every time I made a suggestion, they would look at one another and ask, "What would Colleen think about that?" Knowing that their bosses were named Paul, Ted, and Bob, I was a bit confused. "Who is Colleen?" I finally asked. "Oh, she's the receptionist," they replied. I am not making this up. These relatively new managers had apparently allowed themselves to be completely intimidated by an overly assertive employee. Another power failure occurs when people shy away from valuable leverage building opportunities. Krista, a rather unassuming client, recently sent me a rather unassuming email. For several months, we had been working on a complex project that was now ready to be presented to her company's executive team. "I don't believe I should attend the executive session," Krista wrote, "because I haven't been able to go to all the project meetings." "Excuse me? Did I just hear the sad sound of a leverage-building opportunity slipping away?" Instead of worrying about appearing presumptuous, Krista should eagerly seize this chance to increase her exposure to the executive group. Fortunately, she finally decided to attend. Perhaps more damaging is the opposite tendency, trying to use power that you don't actually possess. At best, this can cause you to appear a bit foolish. At worst, it can cost you your job. Sometimes people blunder into this error out of ignorance. One of my favorite stories along this line came from a former colleague, a labor attorney named Rick, who was doing some pro bono work for a nonprofit organization that we will call Community Healthcare. The nurses at Community Healthcare had voted to form their own little union, which was not affiliated with the AFL-CIO or any other labor organization. Management was not too pleased about this, since they did not want a union contract. But the company was legally required to bargain with this group. At the first bargaining session, the nurses arrived with a list of demands and handed them to Rick. "The company can't agree to these," said Rick. "Then we won't sign a contract," replied the union leader. "Okay," said Rick, and he got up and left. After several weeks, the puzzled nurses finally realized that they had no power to make demands, only to bargain toward a contract. And since bargaining means give and take, their refusal to sign a contract had actually stopped the negotiation process, making management very happy. They rather sheepishly called Rick to arrange another meeting. The moral of this story is that you should always be aware of the extent of your power. If you want to look ridiculous, just try to use power that you don't have. Ego and arrogance also cause people to overestimate their power. A friend of mine once worked in a small consulting firm owned by two partners. Over the years, he and the three other staff consultants had developed close relationships with many clients, thereby making a significant contribution to the success of the business. When the consultants asked if they, too, could eventually be considered for partnership, the owners foolishly said no. Shortly thereafter, the consultants left to start their own company, taking their knowledge, experience, and client contacts with them. I'll let you guess which business is currently more successful. Power mistakes sometimes spontaneously erupt from lapses in emotional control. During a tense meeting with the CEO and several other managers, Marianne, a young executive, was becoming angrier and angrier. Finally, after a particularly sarcastic remark from the CEO about her quarterly results. She loudly declared that she was not going to be treated that way, left the table, and slammed the door on her way out. Bad idea. When the other person's nameplate says CEO, you're going to lose the argument even if you're right. Fortunately, Marianne had built up some political capital, so the only immediate consequence for her was a referral to an executive coach. Someone with less leverage would undoubtedly have been fired. What is your power history? Power mistakes are usually triggered by our temperament and our history. As anyone with multiple siblings or children knows, people are definitely not a blank slate at birth. Some of us are hardwired to be more aggressive, while others are innately more reticent. Our reactions to power are also learned, however, and personal power lessons always begin at home. Family dynamics are all about power. Perhaps you were taught that good little girls and boys quietly comply with whatever mommy asks them to do. Or maybe you found a role model in Dad, who strictly enforced rules and harshly punished the slightest infraction. Perhaps you were the bossy oldest sibling, or the defiant youngest. On the other hand, your parents may have helped you learn how to share power by involving you in decision-making, and your sibling interactions may have taught you to cooperate and compromise. Experiences growing up vary widely from person to person, but whatever your own childhood lessons about power, I can assure you that they are well entrenched in your personality. They are affecting your current behavior, for better or worse. Behaviors acquired at home often resurface at work because the power relationships are so similar. As kids, most of us had a mom, a dad, and some combination of brothers and sisters. At the office, we now have a boss and an assortment of co-workers. And those who choose to become managers even acquire some children. Many years ago, in the book, I'm Okay, You're Okay, Dr. Thomas A. Harris described three emotional positions from which we relate to others: parent, adult, or child. At work, of course, we are expected to consistently operate as adults. But despite being physical and chronological grown-ups, many people automatically lapse into their familiar parent or child behaviors. Ben, a corporate vice president, constantly shifted back and forth between parent and child mode. Whenever another VP strongly disagreed with him in a meeting, he would shout, curse, and pound the table. In short, Ben threw a tantrum. Afterward, he would meekly apologize to his boss, just like a naughty little boy. Small wonder that both his manager and his colleagues were getting a bit impatient with Ben. Yet his staff absolutely adored him because he protected them from upper management demands and always took their side in disagreements with other departments. Ben operated as a child with his peers and boss, but was a parent with his staff, and an adult with absolutely no one. Culture also plays a role in our reactions to power. Western cultures, such as the United States, tend to value individual achievement and to reward assertive behaviors, such as standing up for yourself, expressing opinions, suggesting improvements, and pointing out mistakes. Eastern cultures, on the other hand, emphasize group harmony. They value cooperative behaviors like listening, collaborating with others, striving for consensus, and showing respect for authority. When placed in the opposite culture, Westerners can resemble raging bulls, while Easterners may seem like timid rabbits. To succeed in a different culture, you must model the accepted power behaviors, an observation confirmed by many of my Asian clients who have come to work in the United States. men, women, and power. A recent column in our local paper described gender tensions following the election of our first female county commission chair, a petite woman who replaced a 6'7" man. After years of working with male, female, and mixed gender groups, I have no doubt that a few tensions did indeed accompany this transition. For reasons of biology and socialization, men and women often have different approaches to power. The male power style focuses on dominance and hierarchy. In all male groups, the members will quickly, although often subtly, establish a pecking order. No one may ever mention it, but everyone knows who's the top dog and who's on the bottom. That's why physical size and strength often give men a few extra power points. The criteria for being the alpha male will shift with the situation, however. My husband manages a recreational baseball team whose members come from a wide variety of occupations. But on the team, status derives almost solely from batting average. The mechanic who's hitting 350 definitely has more status than the physician batting 143. Women, on the other hand, approach power differently, building relationships and looking for connections. Female groups may eventually develop some status differences, but that's not where they start. Put a group of unfamiliar women together, and they will immediately try to discover what they have in common. Although overt expressions of dominance are frowned upon, women often exercise power through inclusion and exclusion. They are much more likely than men to play shunning games, for example. While the male power dynamic is up or down, the female version is in or out. Practical jokes and friendly put-downs provide an interesting example because they are almost the exclusive property of men. Women hardly ever engage in either of these exchanges, since the aim of both is one-upmanship. Men, conversely, often know little about each other's personal lives, since they feel no need to connect in that way. If you're thinking that these are broad generalizations, you are absolutely right, because individual power styles are also shaped by family history, temperament, and culture. You do find women who use a male style and vice versa. The most effective people borrow the best from both approaches, developing a more androgynous approach to power. The basic gender differences are still quite common, however. So anyone trying to operate with political intelligence should take them into consideration. A frequent power problem in all male groups is that the preoccupation with dominance often impedes collaboration. Each member may feel that others have no right to interfere in his territory, so everyone limits conflict by operating autonomously. If you never collaborate, then you automatically avoid situations where you might have to give up some of your power. In all female groups, problems are more likely to result from entanglement in relationship issues. Who's friendly or unfriendly? Who's gossiping too much? Who's getting more attention? Who's being too critical, and so on? Interestingly, these matters are often put aside if someone has a personal crisis. Squabbling women can become quite supportive when health or family issues arise. Men, of course, can also offer mutual support, but they may not know that anything is going on. Most groups, of course, are composed of men and women, and most of the time, everyone gets along just fine. But because of the style differences, men sometimes view women as weak, while women occasionally see men as overbearing. Any group member who is the lone representative of a gender may have some adjusting to do. One of my clients was the only woman on an all-male management team whose members were constantly engaged in verbal pissing contests, an unquestionably male expression. To be a full participant in these discussions, she had to learn to speak up and stand her ground. The real challenge for a woman in any male group is that she has to walk a fine line. While she must adopt some characteristics of the male power style in order to be respected, she still needs to retain enough female traits to avoid being seen as a gender deviant. She has to be one of the guys without really acting like a guy. The higher a woman rises, the more important this balancing act may become, because most executive groups are still largely populated by men. On the other side of the equation, I know one gentleman who joined an all-female department after he retired from the military. As you might imagine, the gossiping and little snits among his colleagues nearly drove him nuts. "Why can't they just forget all that stuff and focus on work?" he exclaimed one day. Another male manager had a short tenure in a largely female health care organization because he could never adopt a more relationship-oriented style. Women at all levels, including the CEO, found him to be too aggressive. When acting in accordance with their natural styles, men and women alike can inadvertently give power away. In the presence of someone they view as the alpha male, men may become overly submissive and deferential. I have a very clear snapshot in my memory of a group of highly paid, expensively dressed senior vice presidents gathered on a stage around their CEO, who was preparing for a presentation. They might as well have been panting, drooling, and wagging their tails. I honestly can't imagine a group of women executives surrounding a female CEO that way. But women have power problems of their own, which are frequently reflected in the way they talk. Women are often much too tentative and conditional in their speech. "We should probably do this." "We might try to take this approach." "Maybe we should reconsider." When they have definite opinions, women need to make definitive statements. Women also have a tendency to politely defer to men, allowing them to interrupt and take over the conversation. Finally, women sometimes over-apologize. I occasionally work with a highly competent woman who says, "I'm sorry," in response to almost anything, thereby automatically putting herself in a subservient power position. When I pointed this out one day, she seemed a little irritated by the feedback, but at least she didn't apologize. So, to summarize, your own personal power profile has developed from your innate temperament, your early role models, the culture in which you grew up, and some gender-specific behaviors. Because we each have our own automatic built-in responses to power, you can greatly increase your political intelligence by learning to modify any knee-jerk reactions that might lead you into hazardous power mistakes. Mapping the power grid. Suppose you are the quarterback on a football team. To win, you need to not only sharpen your own skills, but also evaluate the ability of your teammates to support you and the ability of opposing players to flatten you like a tank. The political game works the same way. To achieve your goals, you need to know who can help you and who might hurt you. Instead of reviewing weekly game films, however, you are observing the playing field on a daily basis, trying to assess the relative power of those around you. And because power shifts frequently, you must be on the alert for trend lines. Collaborating with a fast-track superstar can reap valuable dividends, but be wary of anyone whose career appears to be in a tailspin. To provide a method for organizing power assessments, let's create a power grid that considers two factors: level of position and degree of influence. Level of position is easy to rate because it simply reflects the hierarchy. The CEO gets a 10. The lowest paid employee, a 1. and everyone else is distributed accordingly. Degree of influence requires a more subjective assessment. You need to evaluate how many people someone knows, how highly the person's opinion is regarded, how many opportunities he or she has to interact with others, and so forth. To determine a particular person's power level, you must do the following. 1. Assign the person a rating on both level of position and degree of influence. 2. Add the ratings together to get a total political power score. A successful CEO might get the highest score, 20, while a poorly performing mail clerk might get the lowest, 2. 3. Find the point where the two ratings intersect to place the person in a power category. The categories on the grid represent four power combinations. Politically speaking, those on the left side don't have much firepower. Weaklings are low-level, low-wattage employees who may be perfectly competent but have little influence outside their own job responsibilities. Empty suits have high-level positions with impressive titles, but not much else. These are the jobs where politically ineffectual executives go to die. Although empty suits and weaklings don't offer much as allies, you may still enjoy working with them. If they appear to be political suicides, however, keep your distance. For a power boost, you need to cultivate the folks with positions and influence. As allies, they can be most helpful, and you certainly don't want them as adversaries. Persuaders are what sociologists call opinion leaders. Although they don't hold high-level positions, they can influence the views of many people. If you are in a lower-level job, persuaders are probably your most useful allies because they are fairly accessible. It's easier to chat with the CEO's assistant than with the CEO. Power players, of course, are the political superstars. Only a real dimwit would ever intentionally antagonize a power player. And within the category of power players, you find the power elite, an exclusive little cadre of executives with extensive authority and widespread influence. They truly run the show. The more clearly you understand the goals and expectations of the power elite, the more likely you are to succeed. You should therefore pay close and ongoing attention to any power elite member who can affect your future. In a small business, this means everyone at the top. One of my client organizations is a family-owned furniture store with two owners, three managers, and 15 employees. If they're smart, every single employee in that store will clearly understand the priorities of those two owners. In larger organizations, however, each job is linked only to specific power elite members. An accounts payable supervisor, for example, probably doesn't need to know much about the vice president of sales, but should definitely keep an eye on the CFO. The power elite create the culture. An organization's culture is largely determined by the beliefs, values, and preferences of the power elite. This realization hit me when I experienced the dramatic change that accompanies the arrival of a new CEO. The transformation in the company was like having your mother's body taken over by a space alien. It still looked like your mother and sounded like your mother, but in reality, your mother had become a very different and possibly hostile being. This massive culture shift was due solely to the dissimilar values and work styles of the two executives. The former CEO was gregarious and outgoing, had an engineering and marketing background, and was extremely close to his wife and three children. The new CEO was reserved and analytical, had a finance and consulting background, and lived alone. His first year produced marked changes in everything from business strategy to accounting practices to hours of work. There was a major turnover in the power elite as well. He fired all the top executives, thereby creating additional culture change in every department. Such a large-scale adjustment is stressful, tiring, and a royal pain. But for political success, and sometimes for survival, you must adjust to the culture established by the reigning power elite. There is not one chance in a million that you are going to change it. Some people expend a great deal of time, effort, and energy fighting a hopeless battle against the culture. When Diana first became a project manager, she was determined to deliver projects on time and within budget. She soon discovered, however, that no one else paid much attention to either schedules or expenditures. Because of changes made by various executives, including the president, every single project experienced delays and cost overruns. To address this problem, Diana introduced a structured project management process with strict timelines and due dates. But nothing changed. With each overdue project, Diana became increasingly unhappy, irritable, and argumentative. The executives began to complain that she was uptight and obsessive. In her determination to make everyone do things the right way, Diana completely failed to recognize that her power elite group values flexibility and ingenuity more highly than they do structure and consistency. They would be much happier with a project schedule that builds in time for exploring new ideas and changing plans. Unless she can adapt to the prevailing culture, Diana's political stock will undoubtedly continue to decline. When the culture seems uncomfortable or wrong, give yourself a reasonable amount of time to adjust. Then, if you still feel like a misfit, you may need to move on. Putting a person into a company is kind of like an organ transplant. Sometimes the new part turns out to be compatible, and sometimes not. Just as the body will eventually reject an incompatible organ, a company will eventually reject an incompatible member. Some transplants just don't take. So if the values of the power elite seriously conflict with your own, you need to take your talents elsewhere. Otherwise, the stress will ultimately make you sick or drive you to some politically suicidal action. Careful observation and a little detective work can help you determine the values of your own power elite members. 1. Don't just listen to what they say. Watch what they do. Why do the public pronouncements of all companies sound exactly the same? Because they all want to project a positive image. Don't rely on press releases or the annual report to clarify the true values of the power elite. Only an insane executive would ever publicly say, "Customer service is somewhat important, but we're really much more interested in getting their money." Or, "We don't want to do anything illegal, but we do want to use as many accounting tricks as we can." Actions are much more revealing than words. Do they care about customers? Watch the staffing level in the customer service department. Is quality important? Take a look at the acceptable error rate. Do they really mean that stuff about work-family balance? Check out how many managers are coming in on Saturday. 2. Notice what they like to talk about and how they work. People tend to talk about things that interest them. So if you have opportunities to chat with the power elite, take note of the topics that turn them on. A vice president who enjoys discussing new programs and innovative ideas is likely to appreciate creative suggestions, whereas one who gets excited about procedures and policies may welcome efforts to standardize operations. Personal work habits also provide a clue. Does your CEO work long hours? Always start meetings on time? like to brainstorm new ideas? Spend time getting to know people? A personal work style often reflects what someone expects of others. 3. See who gets recognized, praised, or promoted. The power elite control various types of rewards, so notice where those rewards go. One of my clients was recently told by her vice president that she should look to a particular colleague as a role model. Even though she personally believes that this colleague is a moron, she needs to recognize that the VP views him differently. Her boss is trying to send her a message about what he thinks is important and is probably suggesting some changes in her behavior as well. 4. Ask your boss or connected colleagues. If you seldom have direct contact with the power elite, then learn from those who do. Cultural coaching is one of the most valuable contributions that a mentor can make to your career. So select a mentor who has enough sense to make accurate observations. If your boss is a decent human being and reasonably bright, he or she is your most obvious and available source of inside information. As long as they know you won't repeat their candid remarks, bosses generally love sharing their views. It's a kind of therapy for them. 5. Observe what they change. When someone new joins your power elite group, remain hyper alert for anything that signals a shift in the culture or in what's expected of you. I once worked in a department that experienced a major change in decision-making style with the arrival of a new vice president. Whereas his predecessor had liked face-to-face discussions and quick decisions, the new VP preferred written proposals and consensus-building processes. This was neither good nor bad, but it was definitely different. And we all had to adjust our behavior accordingly. Sometimes, however, you get mixed messages. When two extremely powerful people have conflicting goals, priorities, or values, the result is a confusing and politically hazardous situation. Here's a common example. An experienced CEO decides to appoint a president to handle day-to-day business operations. Perhaps the CEO wants to spend more time on strategic issues, or has decided to retire and wants to groom a successor. But a funny thing happens when the new president actually begins to make decisions. The CEO suddenly discovers that giving up power is difficult, marking the beginning of an uncomfortable and unproductive power struggle. Picture a couple of bull elephants fighting for dominance of the herd. If you see this happening, watch out. You are entering the political danger zone. For a while, you and your colleagues, like the elephant herd, will have no idea which way to turn. The good news is that these conflicts are always time-limited, since no organization can operate with this kind of tension for long. The winner will be determined by the relative power of the combatants. But because underlings can't always accurately assess the leverage equation at the top, your wisest course is to lay low, offend no one, avoid taking sides, keep your opinions to yourself, and just wait it out. Believe me, you'll know when it's over, because someone will be gone. Personal politics. How much power do you have? Assessing your situation. Think of someone you regard as a role model for exercising power and influence wisely. Now compare yourself to that person in the areas about to be listed. Use the following scale. 3 equals definitely. 2 equals somewhat. 1 equals not really. Power builders. Has responsibility for results that are perceived as valuable. Is included in or consulted about important decisions. Is allowed to make independent decisions about their work. Has information or skills perceived as valuable by management. has access to important or influential people, has contact with people in many parts of the organization, is trusted with confidential information, is involved in important projects, has expertise that is hard to replace, is listened to by others when speaking, appears confident and self-assured, is well-regarded by people at all levels, turns disagreements into productive discussions, conveys interest and enthusiasm about work, includes other people in decisions and activities. Moving from assessment to action. Look at the items on which you gave yourself a low rating. What could you do to increase your score in that area? If you scored your role model high on any of those items, what can you learn from that person's behavior? Might he or she agree to become a coach or mentor for you in that area? Think about the power elite in your organization. List the results, values, and behaviors that seem to be rewarded by this group. Remember to consider what they do, not what they say. Do you need to make changes in order to be perceived more positively by power elite members? If their values and priorities don't match your own, are you in the right organization? What is your power profile? Assessing your situation. Consider the factors that may affect the way you react to power. Give some thought to your power lessons and how they influence your behavior at work. Natural temperament. Do you tend to be more aggressive, calm, or anxious? This is my nature. So this is what I tend to do. Family members. Consider mother, father, siblings, or other influential family members. How did they use power or react to power? This is how power was dealt with at home. So this is what I learned. Current relationships. Consider spouse, significant others, friends, children. How do they use power or react to power? This is what I experience in my current relationships. So, this is how I react. Gender behaviors. How may you reflect the expectations that society has of male or female roles? These are the gender expectations that I perceive. So, this is what I tend to do. Culture. How is power used in the culture in which you grew up, in the culture you are in now? These are the cultural expectations that I have learned. So this is how I react. What kind of power mistakes are you most likely to make? Are you too controlling and dominant or too reticent and afraid to use power? Do you defer too quickly or become too aggressive? What would you like to change about A, the way that you handle power yourself, or B, the way that you react to others with power? Moving from assessment to action. Identify the specific power situations that may cause you to make power mistakes. Do you get frustrated in meetings and react aggressively? Do you get easily intimidated by managers and give in too quickly? Do certain people just seem to activate your unhealthy power reactions? Determine how you will handle these situations differently in the future. Practice these behaviors until they feel comfortable. Part 3. How to Become a Winner. Chapter 8. Increasing Your Political Power. When you think about your own political situation, you probably have something in mind that you would like to accomplish. Perhaps you hope to achieve certain career objectives or resolve some dilemma at work that is driving you crazy, or maybe both. Whatever your current concerns, here is an important fact to keep in mind. to achieve any goal, you must have sufficient power. Having a sense of power is important because people who feel powerless almost always feel hopeless and trapped as well. Hopeless, trapped people don't contribute much to the greater good. They typically spend a lot of time wishing things would change, but seldom set any specific goals. If you need help differentiating an unrealistic wish from a realistic goal, try a political power check. For instance, you might wish with all your heart that you could get rid of your boss, but you probably don't have the power to pull it off. However, you almost certainly have the power to make that relationship better if you choose to do so. Dumping your boss is a wish. Improving communication with your boss would be a goal. Enhancing your political power will automatically increase the number and variety of goals that you are able to achieve. If you are a winner, the desire to increase your power is not merely self-serving, since you will always be working for the success of the business. The four P's of political success. Although politics is a pretty fuzzy term, there is a clear formula for political success, and it does not involve sucking up, groveling, or backstabbing. If everything is rolling along smoothly in your working life, that's terrific. But if not, the four P's of politics can help you put together a political game plan to improve the situation. Power assessment. How can you improve your leverage position? Performance. How can your work make the business more successful? Perception. How can you enhance your reputation, especially with those who can help you achieve your goals? Partnerships. How can you increase your network of allies and supporters? By thoroughly evaluating these four factors and making necessary improvements, you will automatically increase your political power. Does this formula guarantee a quick and painless solution to all your problems? No. Ruthless honesty and difficult changes are often required. But the reward is that you are more likely to achieve important goals and feel in control of your life. As we focus on increasing your power, however, you must remember the political golden rule. Never advance your own interests by harming the business or hurting other people. Gale's political problems. To illustrate this four P's formula, let's examine one person's political dilemma. Gale is a technical publications supervisor in an electronics company, responsible for producing the instructional manuals packaged with all company products. When I first encountered her, Gale was like a powder keg, ready to explode at the slightest spark. She absolutely radiated stress, frustration, and anger. And a great deal of that anger was directed at her boss. Here are the wishes she expressed during our initial conversation. I wish things were done in a more planned and orderly fashion around here. I wish that my group was more involved in product planning. I wish product managers wouldn't dump work on my staff at the last minute. I wish I had a title that matched my responsibilities. I wish my boss would try to help me solve some of these problems. If Gale ruled the universe, she would immediately make radical changes in her job, her company, her colleagues, and her boss. As it is, she feels completely helpless to change anything. So, using the four P's, let's diagnose her current political situation and see what she could do to increase her power. Power assessment. To evaluate Gale's leverage, we must consider both position power and personal power. Although she has little direct authority, Gale's job in technical publications does afford some position power. While producing manuals is not a glamour job, The fact that they are seen by every single customer is a potential leverage booster. Because all product-related information converges in the manual, Gail has connections with many people throughout the company. Unfortunately, her chronic frustration and anger have diminished Gail's personal power, because everyone tries to keep any interaction with her as brief as possible. Gail could really use some support right now, but she has alienated most of her potential allies. Performance. Performance is definitely Gail's greatest political strength, due to her department's reputation for consistently producing high-quality work under extreme time pressure. The company hardly ever receives complaints about the manuals created by Gail and her staff. Although writing manuals may not be glamorous, the importance to customers is evident. Perception. On the positive side, Gail is universally viewed as thorough, conscientious, and dedicated to customer service. Nevertheless, perception is a problem for her on two levels. First, the difficulty of her work is greatly underestimated. Few people really understand how much time and effort it takes to produce a complete, accurate, and comprehensible manual for the company's complex products. Nor do they realize how much extra work is created by last-minute changes to a product's name or features. Second, and more important, Gail is widely considered difficult to deal with. When describing her, people use words like stubborn, intimidating, frustrating, harsh, impatient, and critical. She clearly does not have the reputation of a political winner. Partnerships. Gail is definitely not adept at forming partnerships. When discussing any problem, she quickly becomes adversarial and confrontational, in part because her frustration level is always so high. Because she lacks the authority to make the changes she desires, Gail badly needs the cooperation of others. The others, however, see no evidence that she is open to compromise on any issue. In addition to lacking political intelligence, Gail is probably something of a martyr. She is currently so consumed by anger that she could easily be headed for political suicide. Gail desperately needs a political game plan. The performance principle. True political power is based on valued contributions. To become a political winner, you must produce results that make the business more successful. Unfortunately, we have all seen some apparent exceptions to that rule. The highly connected, highly paid, lame brain who doesn't really do anything useful, or the cute little cupcake who gets whatever she wants because she's very cuddly with her boss. Sometimes people do receive benefits that they haven't earned. One of my personal favorites was a rather nerdy guy with dandruff, who suddenly showed up one day as our company's new governmental liaison. We had never had a governmental liaison, mainly because we didn't need one. This fellow, however, was not only given a six-figure salary, but the company also paid to ship his three horses across the country. He was a fairly harmless guy who spent his days doing, well, something. He walked around a lot. I think I forgot to mention that he was a cousin of the company president. These scenarios obviously provide more evidence that life's not fair. As we have already established, however, fretting too much about fairness only wastes energy that could be put to better use. But let's think about such situations politically for a moment. Because they add little value to the business, these parasites actually have limited leverage. Their political power and their ultimate fate are completely determined by their association with one particular person. The cupcake will only do well as long as her boss is successful, or until he finds another playmate. The aforementioned cousin suddenly disappeared when the president retired, as did the need for a government liaison. Without value-added performance, these slackers have little control over their own future. And the resentment they engender in others is a definite political liability once their protector is gone. True political power develops from a track record of significant business contributions. Develop an ROI mindset. Implementing the performance principle requires an ROI, return on investment, mindset. ROI simply means that every monetary investment is expected to return certain benefits and is therefore evaluated on how well those expectations are met. To your organization, you clearly represent an investment on two levels. Management made the first investment decision when they created your position, then another when they hired someone with your particular experience and qualifications. Although they may never have been clearly stated, expectations do exist about the return that you should provide. Here are some questions to consider. Do you know why your organization decided to invest in you? Do you know what return management expects? Do you know how to maximize that return? To increase your political power, you must deliver more than the minimum expected ROI. Applying ROI to your own position may seem a bit odd, because managers seldom think or talk about jobs this way. If you say to your boss, "What does this company expect from its investment in me? And how can I maximize that return?" she'll probably look at you a little oddly and wonder if you were paying attention during your last performance review. However, evaluating your personal ROI requires a broader view than simply understanding your current work objectives. You need to know how you, in your particular role, can make the company more successful. Let's take a couple of examples. Remember Greg, the tax specialist from the previous chapter, who rose to become vice president? Greg could have met basic expectations for his first tax job by simply ensuring that the company complied with all applicable regulations. But, thinking with an ROI mindset, what else can a tax specialist do to increase his company's success? For one thing, he can know federal, state, and local tax law so thoroughly that he is able to advise management on the tax implications of any decision. Because money saved on taxes goes straight to the bottom line, Greg's comprehensive grasp of the tax code visibly contributed to the company's financial success and increased Greg's political power as well. By becoming a regular participant in most high-level management decisions, Greg acquired broad business knowledge and greater visibility with the power elite. A clear convergence of personal and organizational goals, the sign of a true winner. Having a specialty may give Greg a slight advantage, but any job can be viewed with an ROI mindset. Let's consider a more common, less specialized position. Customer Service Representative, CSR. These are the folks who typically spend their days on the phone solving problems for unhappy, stressed, and frustrated customers. A manager, bright enough to consider personal ROI, might say this to a group of CSRs. You are a crucial link between this company and our customers. To them, you are the face or voice of this business. You can influence their decision to purchase our products in the future. Collectively, you probably know more than anyone else about what is making our customers unhappy. Because few managers think like this, my guess is that most CSRs never hear that speech. They are more likely to be told to shorten their customer calls. Even if no one else sees the potential of this position, however, a CSR with an ROI mindset will have a more enlightened view. With that ROI attitude, he will make every effort to give customers a positive impression of the company, solve problems quickly and accurately, and find opportunities to promote company products. If obtuse power elite members see customer service as a necessary evil that sucks up money, a few CSRs with an